The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading you from Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Okay, let's start off July with a letter from the editor, a note from the editor. Harpo speaks, and he's got a picture here of the Marx Brothers making their silliness usual stuff. A chat with R&D humor editor Andy Simmons about the art of a one-liner includes tweets. Me, there's a lot of humor online. Searching for comedic gold must be like looking for a strand of hay in a stack of needles. At times painful. How do you do it? Andy, the humor team, Emily Goodman, Caroline Fanna, and I, has a list of go-to comics and sites. But you need to pack a lunch because before you know it, you're tumbling down the rabbit holes chasing gags. Don't tell my boss, but I've spent many a pleasant afternoon doing just that. Me. Okay, take this one about the 100 funniest tweets ever. I bet when the first guy wore glasses, everybody was like, ooh, la-di-da, excuse me, mister, I need two monocles. That's brilliant. What do you know about Apple at Rob Free? Andy, nothing. Me. So these are just average folks thumbing away? Watch yourself, bub. Average folks send Reader's Digest a million gags each year, but yes, Twitter is the great democratic experiment of the day. Every genius or idiot can have his or her say. Some are stand-up comedians, some are someone's mom. Their rotten jobs and misbehaving kids are humor gold on Twitter. Me, how do you pick them? Andy, first they have to crack me up. Second, they have to crack you up. Third, if our managing editor says, can we get away with saying that word? We don't run it. Me, well, one hint about me is I especially love this one-liner also in the 100 funniest tweets ever. My parrot died today. His last words were, darn. I think my parrot is about to die. Ha. Absurdity must be a 21st century thing. Andy, I have two words for you. Harpo and Marx. Was there anyone more absurd? And he was cracking us up 90 years ago. Me. Any last one-liner for the audience? Andy, yes. One stolen from him. That's for Bruce Kelly, editor-in-chief. And now for some letters and notes on the May issue. Road trips. Utah's Canyonlands, also lauded as one of the quietest places on earth. When we visited, we waited for other hikers to leave and then closed our eyes and just listened. No wind whistling, no birds chirping, insects buzzing, or ambient sounds whatsoever. It was an eerie experience I'll never forget. And the scenery was spectacular, of course. That's from Diane Armstrong in Colorado Springs. Jerry's Dirt. I thought I was a tough old bird, but had to shed a few tears for this interesting man and his love for the planet, science, flora, bees, birds, animals, and his family. He certainly left this earth better than he found it. Alan Craggood, Whitestown, Indiana. News from the world of medicine. The antibiotic continuous glucose monitors hit home for me. My husband, who has type 1 diabetes, developed hypoglycemic unawareness, the inability to feel his sugar, blood sugar dropping. Oh, God, I can't imagine that. Which causes him to become confused. When CGMs came out, I no longer had to try to reason with someone who was disoriented. Now the monitor beeps and I just say, your second wife is calling. Denise Brady, Las Vegas, Nevada. Don't panic. I was stationed at Ellendorf Air Base in an Anchorage Inlet, Alaska earthquake occurred. The building I lived in had a long hallway with exits on each end. During the quake, it swayed so much that you couldn't see both at the ends at the same time. Our planes bounced around like toys, and we felt aftershocks for at least a year. Vernon Crozier, Teresa, Wisconsin. Where, oh where? For me, having lived in Portland, Oregon for several years in the mid-1970s, the view of Mount Hood in the distance was a dead giveaway for the location of the tulips in this photo. Susan Redding in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Saluting Arlington Cemetery. I have an additional veteran to mention who is also buried in Arlington, Audie Murphy. He was one of the most decorated combat soldiers of World War II. I think he was the most decorated, receiving every combat award for valor from the U.S. Army, as well as one from France and another from Belgium. He was also a singer, songwriter, actor, and rancher. Fast food was our love language. The author states a very common feeling among children with deceased parents. There were questions I never thought to ask. There are so many things now I now want to know about my father. Why did he attend public high school for 3 years but then transfer to a private school? Why was he so timid that he rarely even went into a store? He built cameras, repaired automobiles, and taught himself Russian later in life. But there is so much I don't know about him, and now I have no way of finding out. Marvin Case, Vancouver, Washington. A World of Good. As caretaker for my brother who uses a wheelchair, I love the idea of a Lego ramp like the ones Rita Ebel builds for shop entrances. We often have difficulty getting over a step to enter a building. When I told my brother about this story, he agreed it'd be nice to have a Lego ramp. But he had a question. How much does it cost? An arm and a Lego? Shannon Haney, Kalamazoo, Michigan. And immune responses. Thank you for how to strengthen your immune system. A lot has been said about hand washing, masks, and social distancing, but not about how to improve our immune systems. It's good to be protective, protect ourselves from the outside, but more important to do so from the inside. Barbara Epps, Weatherford, Texas. I used to live in Weatherford. A doctor once noted that my husband and I must be doing something right to have such healthy immune systems at age 60. All we did was eat blueberries every day. Now 80, we still play tennis and sleep well, and we never go a day without our blueberries. Judy Williams in Sanibel, Florida. And then there's a picture of the famous scene, if you have seen the movie Ghost, where she's making a pot and he's reaching around behind her and putting his hands on the pot as well with the clay. When the spirit moved you, have you ever seen a ghost? Not the scary kind. We think you more of a spiritual visitation or encounter that seemed like a sign from a departed loved one, maybe in a dream, or like what Demi Moore went through in Ghost. If you had such an uplifting and inspiring experience, we'd like to share it with our Reader's Digest readers. Tell us about yours and see the terms at rd.com/ghoststory. So you've had it rough. Good. How we approach hardships could tell us how long we'll live. I'm sorry, I'm having tongue troubles here. During World War II, an American woman named Shelley Smith Mydens reported on the conflict for Life magazine. Along with her husband, the photographer Carl Mydens, Shelley documented battles in both Europe and the Pacific. Midway through the war, the Mydens were captured in the Philippines. The Japanese held them in a POW camps in Manila and Shanghai. But despite spending 2 years as prisoners of war, both Mydens survived and went on to live long and productive lives. Shelley lived in 86, while Carl made it all the way to 97. Many who survived the war were not so fortunate. A U.S. serviceman named Philip, who was also in the Pacific Theater during World War II. Even before the war, Philip was prone to anxiety and catastrophizing, always predicting the worst. After he returned home, these traits intensified. Philip drank heavily and separated from his wife. Frustrated and resentful about his time overseas, blaming it for his failed marriage, Philip escalated his drinking, he tended not to exercise, and he was occasionally depressed. He died at age 64 of a heart attack. The Mydens and the Phillips were very different stories were recounted in The Longevity Product, a book that summarizes an 80-year study based on interviews and health data collected from approximately 1,500 people. Each followed from youth until death. Its authors came to an unlikely conclusion. We found that many people who lived through hard times went on to live long lives, says co-author Leslie Martin, Ph.D., a professor of psychology at California's La Sierra University. Unlike Philip, for whom the war seemed to push life onto a self-destructive path, Martin says that the Mydens appear to turn their World War II experience into a source of motivation. They didn't see their stress as meaningless. It seemed to fuel them, and this ability to think about the hard things we go through as ultimately beneficial seemed to be important. Eat right, exercise, avoid stress. These vague directives are often framed as the necessary ingredients for a long and healthy life. There is definitely some truth to each of them. But those who have studied longevity say these are oversimplifications. They tend to prioritize action over attitude. While day-to-day habits and behaviors matter, a person's approach to life, including, and maybe especially, the way he or she acts to hardship, is arguably the more important side of the longevity coin. Confronted by difficult times, a lot of people start drinking, smoking, abandoning exercise, cutting ties with friends, or making other unhealthy choices. These new habits can be hard to kick once the problematic period has passed. However, certain qualities seem to safeguard some people from such pitfalls. Experts say one quality consistently tops the list. In terms of personality characteristics, the strongest predictor of a long life is being high on conscientiousness, says Martin. Conscientiousness refers to someone who is organized, prudent, and persistent in their pursuits. Conscientious people are planful, and responsible, not impulsive, she says. When they take on a task, they don't give up easily. This may come as a surprise to those who assume carefree, take-it-easy types are best insulated against life's many injuries and injustices. We actually found the most cheerful and optimistic people live shorter lives, Martin says. Being a worker, being worried or anxious all the time is a problem, but a little worrying, when you're thinking ahead and working through scenarios, can help you to be better prepared. Conscientious worriers tend to put their fretting to good use. They make choices or changes in response to their concerns. Their worrying is productive, not pointless. While conscientious people are not totally risk-averse, they're judicious about risks they're willing to take. These are folks who tend to wear their seatbelts, eschew heavy drinking or drugs, and avoid other sources of undue risk. Conscientious people also tend to adopt and stick with healthy habits, and their awareness and diligence tend to lead them into healthy relationships and jobs. All of these tendencies promote a long and healthy life. Peter Martin, Ph.D., a professor of gerontology at Iowa State University, makes it clear that anyone who has lived to 100 has faced many difficult situations. He echoes many of the above sentiments and mentions a few other characteristics that the long-lived seem to share. They're not uptight or neurotic, he says. While not blasé about life challenges, people who live a long life usually don't catastrophize, that is, they don't assume the worst, which is a habit that can lead a person to make choices that get him or her into trouble, such as prematurely abandoning a healthy routine or a promising enterprise. Additionally, he says, those who live a long time also tend not to engage in upward comparisons. They don't spend a lot of time comparing themselves or their circumstances to those who are more fortunate. Instead, they think about people who have it worse or in past situations they endured that were even more difficult. Another underappreciated element of longevity is something Peter Martin refers to as gerotranscendence, which roughly is a preference for a cosmic or spiritual worldview rather than a materialistic or strictly rational one. He says many long-lived individuals seem to lead toward the spiritual as they age. You see a pronounced reliance on religious beliefs, on putting faith of a higher power's hands, he says. Adopting a more spiritual attitude may allow people to better work through the aspects of life that they find inscrutable or disconcerting. When you're able to hand things over to a higher being, that's a way of letting go, he says. At a certain point, letting go can reduce anger, frustration, and other emotions that push people toward unhealthy thoughts or actions. Walter Longo, Ph.D., is director of the Longevity Institute at the University of Southern California. In 2019, Longo traveled around Italy to speak with centenarians in an effort to uncover patterns that might explain their enviable longevity. He says that two themes emerged. One was genetic good fortune. They'd say, my sister made it to 94, my brother to 98. So genes played a big part in it, he says. The other story was the person who did not have any long-lived siblings or parents, but was in a concentration camp during World War II. And in other words, something about living through incredible hardship seemed to bestow longevity on certain survivors. Longo has a couple of theories about what that something could be. The first is based on nutrition science. Much of his work, in mice and in people, has found that periods of fasting or caloric restriction can help clear away dead or dysfunctional cells in ways that may discourage the development of disease and also promote longevity. If we give mice low levels of protein or calories for a while, then we feed them normally, they live longer than mice we fed normally the whole time, he says. While malnourishment is an extreme and inhumane example of forced deprivation, Longo points out that many places in the world where people tend to live into very old age are also places where people eat a vegetable-centric and meat-restricted diet. Along with clearing away dead or diseased cells, eating this way could cause epigenetic changes that affect lifespan, he says, referring to diet-induced alterations in the way some genes are expressed. His second theory is more of an observation. One thing all these centenarians had in common is that they all wanted to live. They wanted to go on, he says. They didn't say, I'm ready to die, or I don't care anymore. They were still interested in life and paying attention to everything. While most people are passionate and engaged when they're young, a great many lose those attributes as life wears on. And this loss seems to matter. Returning to the story of Philip, the heavy-drinking World War II vet who died young of a heart attack, Leslie Martin Book says that he found his job merely tolerable, and he was looking forward to retirement, though he didn't know how he would fill his time or whether he would enjoy himself. Even in his early 60s, He didn't seem to be involved in activities that gave his life passion or purpose, though some, like Philip, regard tough times as a sign of life as unfair or unpleasant. Others emerge from a struggle with a greater sense of gratitude and a newfound resolve to commit their time and efforts to things that matter, to close friendships, to family bonds, or to hobbies or work for which they feel passionate. Despite their 2 years in captivity, Carl and Shelley Smith Mines gladly returned to Japan when Carl was tasked with leading Time Life's Tokyo Bureau, and the two continued to be engaged writing and photographing until the end. While everyone is entitled to a period of adjustment during difficult times, those who endure will not let those difficulties knock their lives or attitudes off course for good. If you dwell on the negative, you're not going to do it well, says Warren's Gary Small, M.D., former director of the University of California Los Angeles Longevity Center. But if you can see a challenge as something to rise to, it can be very gratifying to get to the other side. How to live a conscientious life. Experts share transformative tips. Hard times can set off all sorts of bad choices, drinking, smoking, cutting ties with loved ones. These decisions and their consequences often far outlive the trials that spawn them. A drinking habit escalates or a lost friends are never replaced. But there's good news. It is certainly possible to change your personality, and happens pretty quickly, says Gary Small, M.D., former director of the University of California, Los Angeles Longevity Center. Here are four things that conscientious people do automatically, but others can teach themselves to do. Look for a mentor. Spend time with friends and colleagues who are diligent and organized and who have other admirable qualities, says Leslie Martin, Ph.D., a professor of psychology at California's La Sierra University. Associating with people who demonstrate these behaviors can make habit forming easier as their tendencies influence us. 2. Find a purpose. Increasing one's maturity over the years is essential to maintaining good health, says Howard Freeman, Ph.D., co-author of Longevity Product. By this he means engaging in meaningful work, work with a purpose, and doing good things for family, friends, and society. 3. Form deep relationships. Don't worry if you don't have a boatload of friends. When it comes to bonding with others, it's quality over quantity. If you're an introvert with a few close relationships with supported, healthy ties, then that can be as good as being an extrovert with many more ties, says Friedman. 4. Stick to it. Trying all the above is easy. Staying with it is not so much. This is why Dr. Small says the core element of conscientiousness is sticking with the healthy change or ambition once you've started it. The more people push themselves to follow through on their goals, be they easy to achieve or difficult, the more they can build up their tenacity, muscles, or stick-to-itiveness. It's practically a fruit. Of course I believe in science. Like how jelly grows inside of donuts. Items of national interest. And there's a picture of a rugged man. Looks like he's probably in his 50s, maybe his early 60s, wearing a straw cowboy hat, big, big mustache. He's got a dog lying with him. He's dirty and grubby and covered with soil, with ash, and he's standing in what looks like a burned-out forest. I cry for the mountains. After a wildfire swept through the land where his family raised their cattle for more than a century, a rancher takes a tour of what's left and what might come next. It is almost midnight. We have been pushing hard for 18 to 20 hours every day since the Bear Fire, later called the North Complex Fire, took through our mountain cattle range in September 8th, 2020. There was so much swirling in my head, I can't sleep anyway. The fire destroyed the range where our cattle grazed, our cattle, and even worse, our family's legacy. Someone asked my daughter if I had lost our family home. She told them, no, that would be replaceable. This is not. I would gladly sleep in my truck for the rest of my life to have our mountains back. I am enveloped by overwhelming sadness and grief. And then anger. I'm angry at everyone and no one, grieving for things lost that will never be the same. I wake myself weeping almost soundlessly. It's hard to stop. I cry for the forest, the trees and the streams and the horrible death suffered by the wildlife and our cattle. The suffering was unimaginable. When you find groups of cows and their baby calves tumbled in a ravine as they tried to escape, burned almost beyond recognition, or a fawn and small calf side by side as if hoping to protect one another, you try not to retch. You only pray that death was swift. And this happened in the mountains of California, by the way, just north of Oroville and Sacramento. My family has taken cattle to the Plumas Natural Forest since before it was designated such, and now leases a portion of the land for grazing. It is steep land on the western slope of the Sierra Madre Mountains in Northern California, a vast forest of deep canyons, rivers, and creeks, and the high ridges in between. It is not an easy place in the best conditions. My great-great-grandfather started moving cattle into the high country sometime after he arrived in 1852 to look for gold. We were poor Irish immigrants trying to scratch a living from the land. There are six generations who have loved this land, and my new granddaughter, Junie, is the seventh. In these first days and nights since the fire, I often find myself overcome with emotion as I think of the things she will never see, but only hear in stories. Day 1. The fire. When news of the fire broke, my son, Kyle, who ranches with me, and I are sure it can't be as bad as it sounded. We rely on spotty reporting, posted in the local news or the social media. My daughter Kate, a veterinarian who practices about 4 hours away, says, "I'm on the way." My youngest son Rob, a soldier stationed in Louisiana, says, "I have a lot of leave and I'm on a plane tomorrow." At first, we can't get into the range because it's completely locked down by fire officials for safety. We are frantic. We know cattle are dying as we wait. We have close to 400 cattle there, most of them calving or close to calving. They are the heart of the herd. Good cows that know the land. I receive a call from a Pennsylvania number. A wonderfully nice man from the U.S. Forest Service is calling, telling me about the fire because I have a permit to graze cattle in the area. I have to help him find the area on the map. He knows less than I do. Frustrating. Later, I get a call from another fire resource officer from the Forest Service. I ask about access. Well, he says, maybe next week, and only if we can provide an escort. We have to make it safe first. All the cattle will be dead if I wait a week, I politely tell him. I'll figure out an alternative through private timberland and common sense. I call our county sheriff. I have to wait one day, but he provides two sergeants to navigate the roadblocks until Colin and I make it into the range. We make a fast trip to reconnoiter. We are unprepared for the total destruction of everything we have always known. Nothing left. And active flames burning trees and stumps. Shocking. Surreal. We see dead cows everywhere. We go home hoping against hope that we have seen the worst. Only later do we realize this was just the beginning. Day 2. No sound, just death. It is 3:30 in the morning and time to start the nightmare again. Time to find the courage to throw some things in the truck, run with the kids to check and feed the survivors. I work to be optimistic because that's who I am. It's not easy. So many people have offered to help, I am grateful. But we're looking at almost 90,000 acres of incredibly difficult terrain. Much of it is unrecognizable, even to me. Only those with a deep knowledge of these mountains can help. My kids, a few close friends, and I strapped chainsaws and some alfalfa on four-wheelers and set out, hoping against hope to find something alive. It is eerie, and as Bob says, there is no sound in the forest, just death. When we gathered cows, traditionally they were always toward the ridge top in the morning and down by the water in the afternoon. Now we find nothing high up except the occasional dead cow that wasn't fast enough. You learn as you ride through the apocalyptic murk. Rob's head goes up, and I catch the scent at the same time. The scent of death and charred flesh mingled with the acrid smoke that burns your eyes. 8 cows and 3 baby calves in a pile at the bottom of a ravine, rushing into her to escape. A sight you won't soon forget. But when we meet up, Kyle and Kate have great news. They found 16 head at one of our corrals, the largest group to date. I baited it with alfalfa last night. Remarkable. 2 are heifers that I gave Kyle and his wife Jordan for their wedding. Kyle branded it with my dad's original brand. My dad was a cow whisperer and gone more than 4 years after roaming the mountains for almost 90. Maybe he's still helping lead us and the cattle home. Day 3. Last man out. I dread taking my mom to see this tragedy. She will be 90 in less than a month, still loves the mountains and the gathering cows. She's tough, but this could break anyone. She first worked these mountains with my dad in 1948, when she was 18 and he was 21. They had just married. She told me later that she had always loved the outdoors, but really was sort of afraid of cows, since she had not ever been around them. She never told Dad and learned to be one of the best trackers and gatherers in the mountains I've ever seen, knowing every plant, tree, and road. You can learn from old people. Far more valuable than visiting scholars or great consultants is local knowledge and observation. I wish we would listen. I feel bad for the Forest Service personnel. Most of them are great people who work there because they love the land the way I do. But they are chained to desks to write reports and follow edicts handed down from those who don't know. One-size-fits-all regulations are not a solution in diverse ecosystems. I grew up hearing stories from my dad and granddad of the last man out lighting the forest floor to burn low undergrowth. It was a pact between our friends, the Native Americans, who had managed this way for 13,000 years, and the loggers, miners, and ranchers who came later. They worked together because they loved the land and knew the land. I remember one December in the early 1960s. Snow was already on the ground of our ranch. I was about 4 years old and holding my grandfather's hand as he lit some piles of brush on fire to open the landscape. It was a practice he had learned from generations before. A crew from the California Department of Forest and Fire Protection showed up, put out the fire, and lectured him for burning. My granddad was the kindest, gentlest, and funny man as I have ever known, and he was mad. It was the beginning of the end for our forest home. I earned my Ph.D. in animal sciences at Colorado State 35 years ago. I loved teaching and ranching, so I did both, traveling nationally and internationally. As the odd academic cowman, I am the current chair of the California Cattle Council and have served on many other councils and committees. I have walked the halls of Congress and met with legislators in Sacramento and D.C. I advocate for the cattle community and anyone who listens. I invite any legislator or regulator, state or federal, to come with me to this devastation. Put on boots and let's go. Look at the megafires California has experienced in recent years. Almost all of them start on state or federally owned land. The only buffers to the disaster are private, well-managed grazed landscapes. They may still burn, but the fires is not as catastrophic and can be controlled. Watch nature. She will talk to you. Sometimes, most of the times, I think it's as simple as not seeing the forest for the trees. In my academic life, I work with wonderful faculty, staff, and students who were committed to research and teaching. However, we rarely looked at the big picture because we encouraged to publish on our disciplines without seeking out how our work connected with others or how our small piece was part of the larger solution. That siloed thinking plagues most bureaucracies and agencies. We only know what we know. In academia, most faculty is several generations removed from a direct connection with the land. It's no one's fault. It's everyone's fault. Listen to the forest. Listen to the locals. Rescue and recovery, day 4. I hold out little hope for live cattle. We have to get to one more area, Hartmann Bar Ridge, between the Middle Fork and South Branch of the Feather River. It is the farthest north, the most breathtaking, and the hardest to access. One road in and one road out, choked with down and sometimes burning trees. And there's a picture of this gentleman walking along with two cowbells on his hand, charred. We see a burned bear cub trying to climb a tree, and then a mature bear burned but staying in the water trying to ease the pain. We don't euthanize, even though our brains say we should. Our hearts say let them try. They made it this far. We have about 6 miles of road to make passable, but chainsaws and strong hands get us there. I pass several streams and try to wade across one looking for cattle. All of the creeks have close to double flow of last week. It strikes me as strange. I see some springs running that haven't been active for years, and it hits me. We have released the water that the brush was sucking from the land. The Native Americans were right again. Observe. Let nature talk. We see cattle tracks, lots of them. In one pocket, we pick up 14 head with nary a scratch. 2 old cows and a bunch of young stock. These old ladies knew where to hide. Wisdom from days gone by. After a long day, we have 32 alive and loaded. Some may not make it, but we have to bring them home to give them a chance. They made it this far. More jarring, though, was to find 26 dead. That fetid spit of death permeated the walk I used to love. Why did we find over half alive here and nowhere else? If anything, I assumed this steep ridge gave them no chance at all. And a reason that there had been a smaller fire about 5 years ago. The country was more open and the fire moved quickly. More things lived. Trees, wildlife, and cows. Number day 5. We won't quit. We move as fast as we can, opening roads with chainsaws and running four-wheelers down every logging spur. We hope against hope for cow tracks, but there are none. By the end of a grueling day, we have 7 head loaded. 3 are badly burned and will get a chance for feed and water before they most likely die or need to be euthanized. We know of 3 more live cattle that we have seen but not loaded. That may be it. of the 100 brought home so far, but I will be surprised if 80 live. Many have lost their baby calves to the fire. There are no wards. Our crew will be smaller today. Rob flies back to his Army duty station. Kate is back working as a veterinarian. Kyle and I will continue the search, compulsively walking creeks and canyons we have already searched, hoping something straggles in behind. You never know, and you can't quit. That is not who we are. And so we go on. What will happen? This is devastating emotionally and financially. I'm not sure of the next steps. I do know this. We must change our lands management practices if we expect the West to survive. We won't quit. We need to get tougher and stronger. We have never quit for 140 years, and I won't be the first. I'll suffer the bureaucratic maze and try to make incremental changes. And as always, work with nature. I have to. Junie needs to see the mountains the same way we have seen them forever, to have hot chocolate on a cold fall morning and gather cows. It can't be just stories from her granddad. We found an orphan heifer calf today, about 2 weeks old. Her mother didn't make it. Kyle stumbled on her, hiding in one of the few living willow patches along a stream. He hauled her for over an hour straight up from the bottom of the canyon. We caught her, and she is now in a bottle getting milk replacer. The rescue was good for my heart. Junie's first heifer, I decide. They can grow up together. And let's switch over to consumer reports. From the president, what's in your credit score? In college, I once had a summer job at a department store. I did, too. As a perk, it offered employees store credit card. Naturally, I was excited, but I recall my father tempering my enthusiasm with a talk on how important it was to build my credit history. I can't say I fully appreciated what he meant at that time, but it was clear that how I used a credit card could either open or close financial opportunities for me in the future. But that lesson left out an important fact. The big companies that trace my financial history to create my unique credit score can get it wrong. Your credit score ties directly into so many facets of your life, enabling you to buy a home, get a job, and procure an auto or personal loan. Because of that, you would think that it is a transparent process, understandable to every consumer. But as we revealed on How to Fix Your Credit Score, which we'll read later, this couldn't be further from the truth. For far too many, building up and improving one's credit is a never-ending labyrinth. Even small errors can sometimes have big negative effects on your credit score, putting a temporary halt on achieving your financial dreams, a recent Consumer Reports study found. Understanding the fluctuations in your credit score and what you can do to ensure the strongest possible score is precisely the kind of trusted information you depend on getting as a member of Consumer Reports. Your membership also helps us to advocate for needed changes so that you're not alone in protecting your score. We will keep working hard to ensure that mistakes by banks and credit bureaus don't harm consumers. With us pushing for reforms to increase equity and transparency in how scores are determined and altered, everyone can thrive in the marketplace and trust that they have the opportunity to build and improve their credit scores. Keeping your data secure. What's at stake? This is building a better world. So-called dark patterns are website or app designs crafted to trick consumers into taking actions that are not in their best interest. Examples include links and menus that encourage users to spend more money or share more data, or that discourage them from opting out of user agreements or from deleting accounts. How CR has your back. A 2020 CR study uncovered a cluster of these dark patterns, confusing and non-functioning opt-out processes it found were preventing people from exercising their rights under California Consumer Privacy Act, the landmark 2018 privacy law that gives consumers the right to access, delete, and stop the sale of their information. In March, California's Attorney General relied on that study in prohibiting the use of dark patterns to impede a user's choice to stop the sale of their data, a national first. Fighting for clean water. What's at stake? As reported in our May issue, a joint investigation of America's drinking water by CR and The Guardian found that the measurable levels of PFAS chemicals in the vast majority of 120 tap water samples from around the U.S., often called forever chemicals because they don't break down easily in our environment or in our bodies, PFAS chemicals are used to make everything from nonstick cookware to stain-resistant fabrics. The compounds can seep into the water from factories, landfills, and other sources. Studies have shown that exposure to PFAS is associated with learning delays, cancer, and other health problems. How CR has your back. CR is working with companies and policymakers to reduce PFAS exposure His efforts included urging Congress to support a new bipartisan bill introduced by Representatives Debbie Dingell, Democrat of Michigan, and Fred Upton, Republican of Michigan, that would require the Environmental Protection Agency to adopt a drinking water standard for PFAS and declare two specific PFAS chemicals to be hazardous substances. These steps will enable the cleanup of the contaminated sites nationwide. CR is also advocating for California to pass a law banning PFAS in food packaging. Making driver tech smarter. What's at stake? In April's investor meeting, probing the cause of a Texas crash and what a 2019 Tesla Model S stuck a tree, killing the two people inside. An officer at the scene told CR was almost certain that no one was in the driver's seat when the car crashed, raising questions about Tesla's autopilot driver assistance feature, which is not supposed to function without a driver behind the wheel. A Tesla vice president has acknowledged that adaptive cruise control, one component of autopilot, had been engaged during the crash. But on-site tests of a separate Tesla by the National Transportation Safety Board found that the other component, autosteer, was not available on that part of the road, suggesting autopilot could not have been engaged. How CR has your back? CR engineers have since shown that a 2020 Tesla Model Y can easily be tricked into driving on autopilot without a driver in place. A video shows the car driving on our closed test track without signaling that the driver's seat is empty. CR's evaluation does not provide insight into the Texas crash, but our safety experts say it does show that automakers need to do more to make sure drivers are present and paying attention when using these systems. Every car with active driving assistance should have a system to make sure drivers are present and looking at the road, as, for example, General Motors Super Cruise system does. Progress update. In February, spurred on by part by CR's investigators, a House report confirmed what we've been saying for many years. Many popular baby foods contain alarming amounts of heavy metals, and neither baby food companies nor the government has been doing enough about it. Now bills in the House and Senate will require the Food and Drug Administration to establish separate limits for cadmium, inorganic arsenic, lead, and mercury in baby foods. On April 8th, the FDA announced its own plan to reduce heavy metals in baby food, something CR has been asking it to do for more than 8 years. And some letters. Our May covering story, Cleaning Secrets for Every Room, offered smart strategy for making those neglected corners sparkle, helping readers tackle everything from gunked up kitchen appliances to smelly bathroom mildew. Thank you so much for featuring a man on the cover of the May issue during the spring cleaning. You certainly know how to please the ladies. Thank you, CR. I didn't know my dishwasher had a filter. I located it and it was full of gunk. Cleaning Secrets for Every Room. Heidi scores the Dyson V11 outside stick vacuum, but last year, CR took Dyson off the recommended list for reliability issues. So is CR recommending Dyson or not? Editor's note, we're not, and here's why. Though the Dyson V11 cordless stick vacuum received an excellent rating in our lab test for cleaning carpets, bare floors, and more, we don't recommend Dyson cordless stick vacuums because of their fair reliability rating. Brands that get a fair or poor predicted reliability rating are not eligible to be recommended by CR. In fact, at this time, CR does not recommend any cordless stick vacuums because of the generally high incidence of problems within reported by our members. The reported problems include rechargeable batteries that diminish over time or lose their ability to hold a charge at all. A couple of suggestions regarding your decrud your rheumatic vacuum. Having a particularly dirty environment, dog, sand, dust, we discover a way to keep our Eufy vacuum clean that your article doesn't mention. For the roller brushes, we supplement the manufacturer's provided comb by using a cheap hair comb, which gets the small stuff out of the bristles. To keep the vacuum's filter from getting clogged up, we use compressed air to blow out the dust. That's from Gary Davis in Ocracook. Regarding a lush lawn without pesticides, there's a faster, more profound way to stop pollution due to lawns. Stop planting them. The reduction in pollution is exponential. We replaced our 15 acres of lawn with wildflowers suitable for the Michigan climate. They're perennial. They use 2,4-D and fertilizer you wrote about was stopped. Weekly mowing, pesticides, and fertilizer all stopped. Our small pond was healthier. No more chemicals than that either. We could literally sit back and smell the flowers. If we're serious about our habits to reduce climate change, we should start right now. Wind, solar, and electric cars will take a while. As a certified master gardener, I think your article does not know far enough. Lush green lawns do nothing positive for the environment, nor do they benefit the pollinators upon which we depend for much of our food. Leave swaths of lawn for children and pets to roam. Fill the rest with native trees, shrubs, and perennials. They require very little maintenance and watering once established, and will thrill you with a variety of insects, birds, and small animals that will delight your yard. All good suggestions in your article. However, you missed a giant alternative, artificial grass. It has many advantages. No watering, no mowing, no fertilizers, no pesticides, and it's a good selection in sunny and shady areas. Thanks for the article on green lawns. We compost food waste and tree trimmings and have been adding grass clippings from a nearby school. We doubt, but aren't sure, that they use fertilizers, pesticides, or herbicides. If they do, then those chemicals negatively affect the resulting compost. A few kinds of herbicide, mostly picrolan, coprolide, and amoprofilide, are still detectable when applied to grass or yard clippings and then composted. You may want to check with the school to make sure the products, those ingredients, aren't being used on the grass, because it could hinder the growth of many plants, including some veggies. Finally, a wake-up call about fertilizers used for our lawns that might be harmful. If pets eat grass that has chemicals in it, can they get cancer? The link between pesticide exposure in pets and cancer is unclear, though a few studies have found that lawn chemicals might be associated with higher risk of certain type of cancer in dogs. What we do know is that pets can be poisoned by pesticides. More than 15% of all suspected dog poisons reported to the Animal Poison Control Center involved lawn and garden chemicals, according to a 2020 study. If you do use them, follow label instructions and keep the pets away from treated areas. How safe is our drinking water? Did not mention refrigerator water filters. Do any refrigerators pass CR's tests for lead or PFAS in lead? Editor's note, CR does not currently test refrigerator filters, and we did not include them in this project because they are often specific to individual refrigerator models. Some refrigerator models do reduce lead and PFASs. Check on the filter replacement packaging that the filter has been independently tested by a lab, such as WQA or NSF International, and certified to reduce lead and or PFAS. I appreciated what makes a car really comfortable, because I consider comfort an important ingredient in owner satisfaction, but was disappointed that you didn't include an economy class vehicle. My ideal car would be used and easy to maintain, get mileage up in the 40s on the open road, and score well on comfort, including the back seat. I've owned small cars that came close, but none that hit it out of the park. Editor's note, your wish list underscores why we didn't include small cars in our list. By definition, they tend to compromise on key comfort elements due to their size. For small demands that are relatively comfortable, we favor the Nissan Sentra and the Toyota Corolla. Among small hybrids, take a look at the Toyota Prius and the Prius Prime. I'm a sales rep, and 95% of my travel is by car. My key to comfort is how the car treats you when you drive up to 500 miles a day for 3 or 4 days a week, week after week. When you drive as many miles as I do, comfort is a safety and an economic issue. When I drove a Hyundai Sonata Hybrid Limited, it was easy to drive 450 to 550 miles a day. Now that the company has downsized me to a Hyundai Hybrid Iconic SE, I stop at 450 miles because I'm beat. Fleet managers everywhere, read this article. Editor's note, long-haul driving is different from when you're just driving around town. Seat comfort, driving position, ride quality, and noise levels all mattered as the miles and hours added up. In our test, the Ionic delivered 52 miles per gallon overall compared with 44 miles per gallon overall for the Sonata Hybrid. The difference in annual fuel costs is just $105, based on driving 12,000 miles a year. For that money, we prefer the Sonata. And since we're talking about cars, let's go to how to save money on car repairs. Some cars cost a lot more than others to keep running. Our exclusive survey shows that if we're shopping for a used car, here are ways to avoid a problem vehicle. And it's interesting, they have a picture here of a whole bunch of different parts being replaced. For instance, an air conditioner compressment for a BMW 750LA costs $4,453 versus $1,200 for the average cost for cars. Shopping the used car market would be a great way to save money, but some out-of-order monies could be ticking time bombs, hiding problems with shocking high repair costs, and though all cars eventually need maintenance and fixes, the cost can vary violently even for different models of the same brand. To help you avoid headaches later on, Consumer Reports analyzed an estimated repair cost from a RepairPal, a CR partner that helps our members find trusted local mechanics and identify those used models that have egregiously high cost for common repairs. We also compiled a list of the most and least expensive 10-year-old cars to repair and maintain based on survey responses from CR members covering 310,000 vehicles. Then we consulted experts, mechanics at CR and elsewhere to learn why some cars are so expensive to keep on the road and how to plan for those expenses. If you're considering a longer-term relationship with your car or shopping for a used car out of warranty, knowing which models might cost you more is valuable information, says Jake Fisher, CR Senior Director of Auto Testing. You might be wondering if you should keep your car after the lease is over or buy that 5 to 7-year-old luxury model that you always wanted. On the next pages, you'll find which vehicles cost the most to keep and least to keep running and how to protect yourself from pricing problems. And I will give you a personal example of the difference in that. When I was in the military, I owned a Jaguar XKE, and I was having problems with a fuel pump. And my mechanic said, well, you can go to the Jaguar dealer and pay $150 for a fuel pump and put it in yourself, or you can go to the auto parts store and buy an MG fuel pump for $35, which is exactly the same, with the exception that the contacts are on opposite sides. So all you have to do is reverse the wires. And darn if that wasn't the case. So I saved, you know, $65 or more just by listening to my mechanic. So you can, you know, it's interesting how that difference, even though it's the same product, it's just slightly different. Okay, here's the Wallace Butts and Fixes. Some vehicles cost much more to repair than others for the same problems. We used estimates from RepairPal, a CR partner that powers our helpful car repair assistant tool online, to identify some of the cars most likely to run up big bills. Some cars have unique parts or require expensive diagnostic equipment, and others put components into hard-to-reach places that turn a simple problem into a high-cost, hours-long repair. For each fix, we compare the expensive outliers with the average cost for repairs across all models from the past 5 model years. We've also included repair prices for the Ford Escape, a popular mainstream model with relatively low repair costs. Timing belts. Average cost is $679. Some engines use a timing belt to keep valves and pistons moving in sync. If it fails, the engine won't run. I know that very well. If a timing belt breaks on a vehicle with what's called interference engine, the pistons and valves could collide, which can cost thousands of dollars to fix. Timing belts need to be changed regularly. The owner's manual will tell you when. Used car buyers considering a car with a timing belt should ask when it was last replaced. An Audi S8 would cost $1,553. An Audi A8, $1,485, and a Ford Escape would only be $743 to replace it. A water pump. Average cost is $710. If your car's water pump fails, the engine could overheat, leaving you stranded and potentially causing further engine damage. Water pump failure is a common repair for older cars, says John Ibbotson, CR's chief auto mechanic. The Nissan GT-R is a sports car produced in low volumes, so some of its parts are costly. But the Lexus RX450H is a mainstream SUV, and RepairPal reports that it costs over $2,000 more to fix than average. The Lexus RX costs $2,750 to repair it, the Nissan GT is $2,340, and the Ford Escape is $253. AC compressor, average cost $1,200. Air conditioned compressor usually lasts for at least 100,000 miles, says Ibbotson. But even if you can sweat it out hot weather, AC isn't just for comfort. It also helps remove fog from windows, and broken AC can hurt your car's resale value. So even if you get a great deal on a used luxury car like a BMW 750Li or a Lexus GS450, it will cost you a lot more than average to keep you cool if the AC compressor fails. For the BMW, it costs $4,450. For the Lexus, it costs $3,700. And for the Ford Escape, it costs $537. Big difference. Fuel pump. Average cost $1,135. Boy, that's different than what I paid. Luxury vehicles and sport cars that were produced only in low volumes often have unique and expensive parts and repair costs, even if those cars wear a familiar badge from a big manufacturer. It doesn't mean they share the same parts as more mainstream models. For example, Lexus vehicles tend to do well in our reliability survey, but if a fuel pump pays on the rare ISF sports sedan or the Lux Powerful LS460, it'll cost you. A Lexus IS costs $3,750. The Lexus 4S is just $3,700, so it's $50 cheaper. And the Ford Escape is a massive $713. Starter, average cost $630. In the case of the sporty Audi RS5, the starter is hidden away where it's impossible access without removing other parts first. An increasingly common problem as some cars get more tightly packaged, as Jill Trotta, Vice President of Industry and Sales at RepairPal, and also an ASE-certified technician with 30 years of experience. A lot of times, I don't think there's a huge connection between the people who design the cars and the people who have to service them. For the Audi RS5, it costs $2,700. For the Mercedes-Benz GL63, it costs just about the same price, $2,700. Ford Escape costs $327. Suspension, shock, or strut. Average cost $937. When the odometer nears 100,000 miles, you should budget for suspension repair or replacement, says Ibbotson. It's unlikely that a performance car like the GTR will be driven that many miles, but many luxury cars, such as the Porsche Panamera, offer optional air suspensions that can be an expensive fix. Air suspension promises a smoother ride and more responsive handling, but their complex system made up of pricey parts. The Nissan GTR costs $5,900. The Porsche Panamera costs $4,800. And the Ford Escapes cost $574. We ask our members how much they spend on repairs and maintenance to keep their cars on the road past the 12 months. Below, we show the most and least expensive 211 models. We also compared average costs by brand based on 5- and 10-year-old models. In addition to new car warranties, some automakers offer free maintenance for the first few years of ownership. But costs can sometimes skyrocket if problems appear once that coverage ends. That's why some brands, such as BMW, can have among the lowest maintenance and repair costs at the 5-year mark, and some of the highest costs for 10-year-old cars. The least expensive 2011 model year cars and trucks and SUVs to maintain and repair. The first generation Nissan EV didn't get pulses racing with driving excitement. It cost owners almost nothing to keep running and also earned top reliability scores. Other vehicles are a better blend of low running cost, high reliability, and smile-inducing owner satisfaction. Currently used cost and retail value. Cars under $5,000. Yearly cost on the Nissan Leaf is zero. $200 for the Ford Fiesta and $200 for the Ford Focus. And they got fairly low owner satisfaction ratings on all of those. For cars $5,000 to $10,000, the Hyundai Genesis is $200, Toyota Corolla $245, and they run down Buick LaCrosse, Toyota Prius, Lexus, Buick Lessons, all are under $300. The Honda Fit, the Kia Soul, the Lexus ES, the Lincoln MKZ are all $300, as are the Total Avalon and Toyota Camry, both of which get very good ratings as far as customer satisfaction and reliability. For SUVs under $10,000, the 250 Kia Sportage and the $300 Honda CR-V. For SUVs for $10,000 to $20,000, Chevrolet Tahoe is $200, and the Toyota 4Runner is $300. For pickups under $10,000, the Ford Ranger and the Nissan Frontier are both $200, but neither of them have very high owner satisfaction. Pickups between $10,000 to $20,000. The Chevrolet Silverado and GMC Sierra are both $200, but low customer satisfaction. The Toyota Tacoma and the Toyota Trunda are $250 each. Ford 250 is $275, the Honda Ridgeline is $300, and the Ram 1500 is $300. The most expensive 211 model years in SUVs to maintain and repair. European luxury cars tend to cost the most to keep in good working order, so even a low-priced used model can prove expensive in the long run. About half the models on this list have subpar reliability, so fixes may be costly and frequent. Cars under $10,000, $1,200 a year for the BMW 5 Series, $800 for the BMW 3 Series. They've got lousy reliability and not very good owner satisfaction. The Audi A4 and the Subaru Alessi are both $500. The cars $10,000 to $20,000, the Mercedes 600, the Acura TSX, Infiniti M 500, and only one of those gives overall reliability, and that's the Infiniti. SUVs under $10,000, $700 for the Acura RDX, the $590 for the Chevrolet Traverse, Cadillac SRS is $530, Buick Enclave is $505, Subaru Air Force is $500, and the Subaru Outback is $500. And none of those get very good satisfaction, customer satisfaction except for the Subaru. SUVs, $10,000 to $20,000. $900 for the Chevrolet Suburban, $775 for the GM Arcadia, $600 for the Honda Pilot, $500, $500, $500, and $500 for the Acura MDX, Ford Explorer, Jeep Grand Cherokee, and the Jeep Wrangler. Minivans under $10,000, $750 the Honda Odyssey, and $500 for the Dodge Caravan. And then they have a chart here that shows snapshot of which each repair costs for 5- and 10-year-old models by brand. And they vary from the Lincoln, ranging for 5 years of roughly $200 to about $400 for thing. The Chevrolets, the GMCs, the Mini Buicks are all about the same. They all run about $400 for 10 years annual thing. BMW is horrible. After 5 years, it doesn't cost much because of the warranty. But after that, it spikes all the way up to $1,000 for a 10-year-old model. Porsche is not much better, as are Volvo, Audi, and Mercedes-Benz. Volkswagen does pretty good, and Jeep is about average. It's about $200 for 5 years and about $700 for more than that. The best way to limit your auto repair expenses is to buy a reliable model. But what if you already own a car with high maintenance costs and you have your heart set on buying a used luxury sports car that you suspect it's going to cost? You can ease some of the pain pocketbook by planning ahead for the inevitable. Here's how. Sell it while you're covered. Buy it with a warranty. Get a pre-purchase inspection, for sure. Check the repair records. Use an independent mechanic. And consider aftermarket parts. All of those would allow you to tell exactly what's going on with your car, and that way you can get an idea of what the cost is going to be, particularly if you're buying it with a warranty. Typically, if you're planning on buying a used car, that typically costs a lot to maintain. Look for one with remaining warranty coverage. Certified pre-owned vehicles come to cost more than non-certified cars, but that typically includes extended warranty coverage. And let's close out with a brief life in these United States. When our tour group entered a cafeteria for breakfast, the woman walking with me made a beeline for the carrot cake. But just as she reached for a slice, she thought better of it and withdrew her hand. As she turned away, I heard her murmur, "No, it's too early for vegetables." I was driving my young twin grandsons when their mother called. As we chatted over the car's Bluetooth speaker, one of the boys yelled out from the back, "Hey, Mom, guess who this is? Is it me or Luke?" After a slight pause, the boy's mother remarked, "He's the smart one." And with that, we have just about run out of time for today's episode of the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next time, and thanks so much for listening.